Hear that? It's the sound of you catching up on all the latest and greatest fintech news, trends, and updates thanks to Streetworthy, Yield Street's bi-weekly newsletter. Stay in the know with CEO Milind Mahiri as he takes a closer look at what's happening in the fintech space, then breaks down what each story could mean for investors like you. Give your portfolio the edge it deserves and subscribe to Streetworthy on LinkedIn today.
Welcome to The Yield, the official podcast of Yield Street. Every week, we bring you the latest market insights across our asset classes and products from subject matter experts. Our aim is to break the outdated mold of investing and help you add financial fuel to your ambitions through innovative investing products and strategies typically unavailable to most investors. Realize your next level with The Yield. Subscribe to this podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and Stitcher. The views you are about to hear do not necessarily reflect the views of Yield Street. This podcast is intended to be strictly informational and is not intended to be and should not be construed as a research report, investment advice, or the offer or sale of securities or any investment product. Now, let's get into the show.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of The Yield. Make sure to subscribe to the show and rate us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or YouTube, and leave a review if you're enjoying the content. In case we haven't met before, I'm your host, Peter Kerr, and I'm the Director of Product Marketing here at Yield Street. Today, I'm joined by Jordy Visser, who is President and Chief Investment Officer of Weiss Multi-Strategy Advisors, the market-neutral pioneer of the asset management industry. Jordy, welcome back to the show.
Great to be here, Peter.
Yeah, excited. We actually have you in studio today. Last time, I think we were one street across each other when we were doing it virtual.
Yes, it's a little different sitting in my office with the video camera on my computer and coming in and being able to.
Yeah, of course, and not to mention you don't have your computer, so you don't have access to all the market intelligence that you typically have. So we'll see what you know off the top of your head.
That's a good point.
So great. So maybe you could walk him through a little bit about your background and also a little bit more about Weiss Multi-Strategy Advisors.
Yeah, sure. So I, first of all, started my career at Morgan Stanley, started in the risk management and controllers area, did a little bit of coding, moved to the derivative area, spent my time in equity derivatives for a long time, had the pleasure to move to Brazil in 1997, opened an office for the firm down in Sao Paulo, Brazil, was there for a couple years during the emerging market crisis, came back, spent my time running the S&P book there on the option side and also the ETF trading. Got to Weiss after I left Morgan Stanley and started my own hedge fund. Brought those people and my strategy into Weiss. So I've been at Weiss since 2005. I joined because I met George Weiss. He's, as you mentioned, a pioneer in the market neutral industry, which means he's trying to produce uncorrelated alpha. And that's a very unique thing. It's what I do as a macro person. I wouldn't say I'm contrarian, but I'm looking for good risk-reward opportunities, and I generally find those when the odds of something happening have changed dramatically, which means I'm positive when there's things like recessions being talked about, and I'm more negative when people see no problems. So I've been at Weiss for that time. We're over 40 years, so we're unique in the industry that we're over 40 years. We have $4 billion under management. Most of that is in a traditional market neutral, you know, or the first fund we had, which is a multi-strategy hedge fund. But then more recently, we've seen a lot of growth in our mutual fund product, and we're very focused on that. We're spending a lot of time with the RIA world and the FA world, and that gives us the ability of talking to a lot of people. And then the only other thing I'd add, we have a very big focus on content and trying to bring, I don't want to say thought leadership for a variety of reasons, but I do want to say we're trying to bring to everyone on a regular basis content that they're not seeing in other places that hopefully gives them the news that they will be reading about in the future. We do this, on a weekly podcast. We do this on webinars. And then beginning next month and into early June, we're actually going to start trying something new, which is releasing what we call morning seeds, which are the notes from our morning meeting we have each day, which is going to be a lot of content, which I think is going to help the FA and RIA world. So a little background on me.
So, you know, last time we spoke, I think it was January, February or so, and we were just starting to really see a little bit of some uncertainty creep into the market. You know, certainly saw a little bit in December or so, but that started to become a little bit realer with market action in the first part of the year. Since then, we've kind of oscillated and gyrated, but we're back down here as we sit at the end of April, kind of in a little bit of a market downturn. Mm-hmm. What do you think are some of the big core drivers for that market action?
Yeah, it's a good point because the first 4 months of this year, and we're about to finish it, it's been at best a roller coaster. And I would say the three dominant forces that have gone on that have created or let's say, positioned uncertainty for the next 12 months. And this is usually what happens during any kind of market downturn. There's usually some question that investors have over the future. Number one, obviously, Russia, Ukraine, that is still hanging over the head of the market to some degree. I think because oil prices have come down, it's not as important. The most important thing to me is the Fed. And I'll jump to the third one and then come back to the Fed. The one that currently and most recently has probably bothered people for the most recent part is that China has this rolling COVID problem. So people can think about it. We thought we were out of COVID how many times over the last 2 years? And the reality is China's now in the worst version of theirs, except for the very beginning. And the problem is it comes at a time where we were hoping there'd be a global reopening. And so when you put Russia, Ukraine on Europe, you've got a slowdown in Europe with a potential recession. You look at China, we're in recessionary territory right now. The data that we're going to see from late March through April is going to be horrific. And then you've got the Fed. And the reason I left the Fed for last is going into the year, it was not expected that the Fed would be this aggressive. They've only moved 25 basis points. So the aggressiveness has been more on the jawboning. And so every day that you come in, there's a new investment bank giving their forecast saying, well, they're going to go 50. They might go 75. They should go 100. We haven't seen this during my career ever. And so investors and the market are just responding with lower multiples because earnings have been good. The economy is still fine. But I think the fear over where rates will be and the other two points that I mentioned have just given the market a reason to turn and be nervous. And so I don't view this as anything more than what we normally go through, but I think it's definitely had an impact.
You know, whenever it feels as though the Fed is ready to shift in policy, it seems like at least market prognosticators tend to probably assume more aggressively in any one direction. So, you know, on the cusp of a Fed rate hiking cycle, you can look back and see at what some of the predictions were for the forward market, and you'd see them kind of always overshooting and then kind of coming down, you know, depending on the Fed speed, certainly COVID being, you know, something where they were going 100 basis points at a time, they tend to kind of overestimate there as well. So do you feel like this is all setting up for, you know, the market assuming a really aggressive multi-hundred basis point hike over the next 12 months that ultimately doesn't occur? Or do you think that this is one of those times where maybe the market's even underselling what the potential Fed action might be?
All right. So I don't like when people say this, but I'm going to say it right now. It's a great question. And the reason it's a great question is because that is normally what goes on, is human beings like to extrapolate the most recent trend further than it should. So when the Fed says, we're going to go 50, we might go 100, we might go this, they go, well, that could be 150, we don't actually know, and the fear starts to grow. The one thing that's different this time from any time in the last 40 years is we have inflation at such high levels. So those prior times were in a much lower inflation world than we currently are. So one of the things I've talked about recently on the podcast that I do is in 1982, we kind of remember that that was the end of theoretically the last kind of hike or the last really bad inflation period that had extended from the 70s into the early 80s. And Paul Volcker got credit for killing it effectively in 1981. In 1982, there was talk of him being named the Time Person of the Year after he had been this aggressive, showing guts and going through it. But the Time Person of the Year in 1982 ended up being the personal computer. And the reason that's important in my mind is that that was when inflation really changed. And what I've looked at is inflation, and I've been talking about inflation being structurally higher since 2020 coming out of COVID because of the printing and the fact that we had no idea how much money was too much. Where I do think people have to remember is we still have technological innovation that is exponential, and that has been suppressing inflation for some time, and it's been deflationary. Now, I think you've got these inflationary pressures, but eventually the tech side is going to come in. So sticky inflation, which is released by the Atlanta Fed on a monthly basis, is around 4.5 on a year-over-year basis. Headline inflation is up at 8 and change. The reason there's that big differential is because for core flexible, so core sticky is 4.5, core flexible is up way past 10%. So it's been the flexible stuff. And the reason the Atlanta Fed did this is kind of advanced analytics. They wanted to see the stuff that could be flexible because of supply chain disruptions and things like that. That's on the higher side. In the 1970s, we had high core sticky and lower core flexible. So I think people have now overshot on a different direction, which is inflation is not as big a problem as people are going to think when we get 6 months from now. And if that's the case, the Fed stuff will fall on its own. But your point is valid. This is what I consider a mid-cycle slowdown, which we haven't seen probably since 2004.
And so, you know, when you think about inflation, obviously it's very backwards looking, but the market also provides proxies for forward looking inflation. Have we seen those start to moderate with kind of inflation expectations overall?
Yeah, 5-year break even tips have come down. They've broken the 50-day moving average. I have other proxies inside the market, in the stock market, in some of the carry trades out of Latin America. Things that were working are now not. The dollar is having a significant move at this point. All of this stuff is starting to build in more deflationary pressures. We've seen credit spreads widen. So this part of it is different. So the first wave of the weakness in January and February was related to a combination of Russia and the shock over what's the Fed going to do. We're in a different stage now where when is inflation going to come down? With the China lockdown, you're getting this. It's probably not going to come down as fast because we've got more lockdowns. Who knows what's going to happen? So the forward inflation expectations are starting to drop, not because of the first side, which is, oh, credit's not that bad, the economy's okay. Now it's actually, hey, the economy might be going into a recession. And the last month, the recession talk has gone up dramatically, where before it was the inflation and Fed talk.
And so, you know, one of the things I think a lot of people have noticed is kind of the variance in performance over the last couple of months of different styles within the equity markets. You know, we've talked a little bit about, you know, how tech has sold off. And I know you've spent a lot of time thinking about this innovation rotation overall. Before we kind of jump into that, you know, I know, you know, you've also done a lot of research and have a lot of, you know, thoughts overall around kind of the crypto space and digital assets. Maybe to kind of preamble the innovation rotation and kind of also what that means to the dollar, right, which is kind of like skyrocketing right now. Maybe you could walk everyone through kind of just your general views on kind of crypto overall.
Yeah, and I'm excited to be here for this reason. I'm a macro person who is not a technology person. I'm also not a crypto religion person, so you're not going to hear me just talk like there's no downside to anything. What I am going to say is over the last year, as a macro person, I started to focus a lot on a belief, and I think everyone should have it. I merged away from crypto, meaning the concept of Bitcoin as an asset I wrote about in 2020. Last year, I started to get focused on the impact that the blockchain would have on our lives, and specifically in terms that I think we can all understand, what Web 3.0 is and what Web 2.0 and what Web 1.0 were, and what that means to our investment portfolios and what that means to the macroeconomy from a global basis. Decentralization and all the things that have always been associated with kind of the libertarian views of crypto, they fit now in a context that I think I can explain to people in the fiat system or the capitalist system that we're used to. It matters for jobs. It matters for your investment portfolios. And I think the message that I've been trying to get out, and I think the beginning of this, it's really important. I think for everyone, they need to know more about Web 3.0, the blockchain and crypto, and how it fits in their daily lives. Because 5 years from now, I will guarantee that every single person who's watching, listening, who's reading about this stuff, if you haven't spent the time on it, you're falling behind. And the easiest way to catch up is to just do as many podcasts and as many YouTubes as you can. So I think it's great that you guys are doing this, and I'm happy to be here.
And so, you know, you mentioned a little bit about Web 1.0, 2.0, and 3.0, but maybe, you know, to start, you can kind of let everyone understand a little bit about how you think kind of crypto overall is permeating or influencing the market at large now. We can kind of go a little bit deeper then into some of the evolutions and kind of where we're going next.
Mm-hmm. Let me give you a little history so people can understand kind of the context of the birth. There's been a lot of digital currencies for a long time. They've all failed. I'm not going to go through the reasons why this one has survived in detail. But the reason it survived is because of the blockchain, which basically means that it can now be audited and we know exactly how many there are. So without going through the weeds, which I don't like to do as a non-technology person, I will say that the Bitcoin paper came out 1 month after Lehman. So September of 08, every single person listening now was questioning whether their bank and their money would be around. And so the birth of Bitcoin came out of that fear. That's the libertarian side. Like, we never want to be at this point where the banks can take us down. Then you've got the government angle. I don't trust the government. You've seen a populist movement. You've seen more things around the world where people don't trust the government. And you throw in the third pillar of the capitalist system, which is corporations. So the bigger corporations, the media, the Facebooks, the Google, the analytics, everything that we have, the trust has been lost. Governments are going after them. And that is what decentralization is about. So the movement that has happened is much more powerful than calling this Bitcoin as an investment about a currency. It's not about replacing the dollar. And I can't say that loud enough. This is not the new currency of the future. We will have those currencies. There's an ecosystem which is growing, which is parallel to the one we're used to. For those of you who have kids that are above the age of 10 and below the age of 20, they live in the digital world more than they live in the physical world. The metaverse to them is not a joke. My son prefers the metaverse over a basketball game. Watching a basketball game to him is boring. I love watching a basketball game. I can't sit and play video games the same time he can. This explosion of this ecosystem is running parallel. Younger people are getting more involved in it. And the problem is the experiential side is growing. So for everyone out there that's thinking about it, I want you to remember it starts as a currency movement. But in the last 2 years, and last year specifically, I think we hit the moment that we all forget, which is around 2010. The iPhone had already been out for 3 years, and all of a sudden, and I guess it was about 2010, we had the App Store. The App Store started bringing developers to Apple. It started bringing people to wanting an iPhone. Before that, it was a replacement, a BlackBerry, a flip phone, whatever. But when we had the ability of it turning not only into a computer of just swiping things, but actually ordering an Uber, ordering food, and going through it, it became a tool. What happened with NFTs last year is we went from Bitcoin to utility function. And now developers and talent are racing into this ecosystem to find ways to use it for basketball, to use ways for gaming, to use ways for different things. So that's what happened, and that's kind of the history of it. I think it's important for people not to get caught in metaverse and Beeple and all these words, which honestly, they're done by the crypto people to make older people not pay attention. And for younger people, they laugh at people. So this is a growing movement, and I think people have to pay attention to it.
And so what do you think some of the implications are kind of just in terms of like investing in financial markets overall, right? So, you know, you've talked a lot about this kind of like innovation rotation. Maybe you could start by walking everyone through that.
So first of all, there's rotations in the market all the time. So for the last 15 years, since the iPhone comes into existence basically in June of 2007. Lehman Brothers happens in September of 08. Bitcoin happens in October of 08. From the period of 2009 to 2021, Apple, Facebook, Microsoft, Google, Amazon dominate the world. And I'm not saying the US, they dominate the world. We control the stock markets of the world. We are over 60% of MSCI world. And so that movement that had occurred was a positive rotation for technology. It was a negative rotation for everything that was physical. So that's what a rotation is. For the last 12 years, every person listening to this has by in some way actively moved dramatically into tech. If they went into passive from active, well, passive is mainly tech at this point. If they found hedge funds that were doing well, those were only on the tech side. So the rotation has been from anything that you can touch to anything that's software and kind of this. And we've replaced, get rid of cameras and replace them with phones, physical to that one thing. So that's what a rotation is to start. The next rotation, what I'm calling the innovation rotation, is not a rotation from physical to software. This one is a great rotation with inside the tech world. This is the first time this has happened. And I'm calling this the biggest disruption to US technology that we've ever seen. And it's the borderless internet, better defined now as Web 3.0, which means the barriers to entry of people to create companies and ideas and turn them into profitable tokens has come out in the last few years. This did not exist. And so a kid in the Philippines can create a business that works in the Philippines and they can make a lot of money and it's represented by a token and all this stuff. They don't need a VC fund. They don't need any, they can just do this. And everyone who's seen their kids make money in the crypto market, that's like getting early into an early stage company, and they've been able to do that because they're on Reddit and they're on these places. The investment world is turning, and the disruption that's happening is happening to the world that we know, which is dominated by US tech. And that is why we are seeing these innovation stocks in the public markets go down so much, including the public companies with inside the blockchain side. They're going down dramatically too. So to use ARK as an example, which is one of the benchmarks for innovation, relative to Bitcoin this year, Bitcoin has outperformed ARK by 68% as of today. If you're in Bitcoin and you're out of ARK, which is not the case for most people, you're doing very well. Even though Bitcoin's down, it's outperforming the NDX, which is the benchmark, and yet Bitcoin is down. So there's a rotation that's happening where you want to be long one and short the other.
How do you think about that, though, in terms of Bitcoin? And, you know, a lot of times people still compartmentalize as being a currency and a means of exchange, mm-hmm. Whereas some of them are also kind of like, you know, living, breathing corporations. And certainly we're seeing, obviously, U.S. dollar take off, as we mentioned a couple of times. How do you kind of square away how people kind of think the utility or how they think about Bitcoin overall in the context of kind of relative performance within the markets?
Mm-hmm. I've tried to come up with an analogy that makes it easy for people on this. So here's the one I'm going to try, which I just thought of as you asked the question. No idea how it's going to fly. You can tell me how it works for you.
Tough judge.
I make up a lot of things on the fly for visuals and kind of an understanding. So let's assume you're at a casino. And each of the tables at the casino is a token with inside the world. So you've got Ethereum, you've got Cardano, you've got Solana, you've got all these tokens, and then you have the tokens that represent companies and stuff. And the house, the chips that you're using, okay, all that money is the bank, the casino. That's Bitcoin. I view Bitcoin as being the currency of that ecosystem of all of the crypto world, partly because it's the OG and it got there first and it went through it, but partly because it's not used as a speculative technology, meaning Ethereum has programmable usage and Bitcoin is really the gold of that ecosystem. And rather than call it the gold, the reason I don't think it replaces the dollar is because I think each of the central banks of the world are going to create a digital currency. China's already very far advanced on this. The U.S. will do it eventually, too. And so maybe we don't have dollars anymore and we have a digital currency, but it's the U.S. central bank digital currency as opposed to using Bitcoin. What Bitcoin becomes is if you believe that people will keep leaving one table and bring their money in. So as they make winnings, it goes into the bank and it just keeps growing and it keeps growing. If you keep getting people to come in with their money from another casino, and let's assume there's one other casino, and that casino is the fiat casino. Right now, that fiat casino has $500 trillion of assets. The crypto casino only has $2 trillion of assets. So every time someone leaves that casino because they like this casino better, they're bringing their money from that casino into this, they're transferring it into Bitcoin, and it just stays there. That is 100% what I think is happening. So I just made that analogy up. Yeah. Does it make sense?
Yeah, it makes sense. I tracked it. Hopefully everyone else did as well. But kind of along those same thoughts, right? Like, do you see a world in which, you know, central banks globally either keep, one, again, they can kind of digitize their currency overall, mm-hmm. but then two, do you see a world in which, you know, they start holding Bitcoin or the equivalent as reserve on any of their balance sheets?
I think without disclosing it, I wouldn't be surprised if a lot of countries have already done it. You've seen the news with El Salvador in terms of changing and, you know, using Bitcoin as their, you're going to see a lot of this. So I haven't really focused a lot on whether central banks are going to do it. I just think, and kind of the other analogy I've used is, you know, when America dominated the world, and let's even use the tech side, and let's use Silicon Valley, why did people come over here to learn how to code and to go work in Silicon Valley? Well, first of all, in the 1990s, about 90%, 95% of the venture capital money in the world was in the United States. And most of the innovation was happening in one little 40 square mile area of, you know, Northern California. So if you were interested in tech and innovating and stuff, and you lived in India or China, you came over to America. When people came over here to get commodities, when they came over here in the 1600s, 1700s, 1800s, 1900s, after World War II, they came to America for a lot of the same reasons that people are going into crypto. They're going there because of decentralization, less regulation, having more privacy on what they're involved in. And so the fact that all of these movements are happening and they're global, and the fact that Russia invaded Ukraine and the first time we've really seen anything like this since World War II, we're entering a different period of time where I think people have to just realize that this movement that is happening and what is going on, it's not about central banks and currencies. It's about people moving into it. And I think the countries of the world are going to follow the people because the people are driving. And one of the things about as we talk about Web 1.0 and Web 2.0, and I think everyone's aware of this, there's been very few winners and there's been a lot of losers since 2009. MSCI World is the benchmark for the pension funds in the world that I live in. MSCI World is up a lot since 2007. MSCI World X the U.S. is down to unchanged. The U.S. has won, and out of the U.S., technology's won. So there's a lot of, you know, people that you're like, how much money do you have in the tech world? You know, Elon Musk, Jeff Bezos. But there's not a lot of winners. And so part of the reason populism has a movement, part of the reason that I think crypto has a movement is because there's been few winners and a lot of losers. And in crypto, you get the opportunity to win. And if it goes the way I think in the blockchain, you're talking about the content makers, the drivers for Uber, the all this being the owners of the business and the middlemen being not completely displaced. So I'm not one of these people that thinks in this utopian world that all of a sudden the drivers and the users will own Uber. They'll just own a bigger share of it. And if they own a bigger share of it, then you've got a redistribution. And I think that's going to happen over the course of the next 10 years. And for people listening, whether you believe it or not, you want to hedge against that. And that's the point for having Bitcoin in every single investment portfolio.
So maybe you could actually bring to life that Uber example, right? So, you know, Uber kind of operates, you know, some technology as a corporation and they contract out drivers overall. How might the driver in this kind of anecdote or narrative overall, like, what do you mean when you say that they get more share of the company or the ownership overall?
Mm-hmm. So in the blockchain world, if let's assume 100 drivers for Uber got together and say, hey guys, let's set up a company. We can charge lower prices than Uber. And here's what's going to happen. All we need is the application to show these people where we are. And as long as the users get this application, so we set up an app, the only thing we need to do is have a wallet of exchange that's inside the block, and then we'll have a token that is kind of like the share of the company. So the one thing about the blockchain and these tokens are like public shares of companies. So they create a token, and then the people that use it are getting pieces of the value. So if the value of the business grows, meaning next month they have 100 more drivers and they have 100 more, each person that goes, the users maybe own, you know, 20%, the drivers own 60%, and then there's some operator of the business that owns 20%. And that's different than the way it is now, where the drivers barely make any money, the users don't get anything but the service, and the middlemen take all the money. If I gave you a different example and use Justin Bieber, most people know the story of Justin Bieber producing content on YouTube. I think this is on YouTube, right? You create content, and the people that created content, most of them didn't get anything for it. They got some likes, they got this, they got a lot of views, but what did they get for it? YouTube got a lot for it. With Justin Bieber, someone smart went out there and said, hey, I need to find my next American Idol, but I don't want to have set up a whole show for it, so let me go to YouTube, see who's got a lot of likes or a lot of views, and let me go get them to do it. And then you find him, you're like, hey, this kid's good. Let's offer him a contract. We'll keep 80% of what he does, and he gets 20. In the new world, as we saw with the art last year with NFT, Justin Bieber's a kid. He's got a lot of YouTube followers, and he goes, oh, great. I'm going to go issue a token. I'm going to start a company. Somebody can buy 20% of Justin Bieber today. He sells an album, okay, an NFT. NFT is his album, for $1. And you get it. And within there is a smart contract which says that, okay, every Spotify song that is played off this album, assuming it's big, you're going to get 20% of the royalties, and we're going to get... And Justin Bieber is going to get 80%. Well, we just got rid of the middleman, the company that did this. And now the people that bought the album, those are like the VC fund that bet on Justin Bieber. Well, those were the original YouTube watchers, but now they have something for it. And if Justin Bieber is worth $5 billion, well, guess what? He now keeps 80% of that, and they keep 20. Now, I threw the middleman out, but let's assume the middleman, the agent, is 10%, and he brokers it. That's different than the 80-20 split, where they didn't have any power. So the music industry, any place where this goes, whether it's drivers who are providing a service or the content providers, which are the ones that should be getting most of the, you know, most of the money, that's the way I see this thing happening over time.
And so, you know, a lot there. So thank you for the analogy. Certainly enlightening for me. So, you know, we've talked a lot about this kind of like, you know, it sounds like you're extremely bullish on kind of the adoption overall of digital assets and crypto. Where do you kind of think we are, right? Like, do you think we're, you know, if we say the whole life is, you know, 100%, do you think, or maybe baseball analogy, 9 innings, right? Mm-hmm. Do you think we're in the first inning? Do you think we're in the fourth inning? Where do you kind of think we are overall in kind of that life cycle?
We're still in the very early innings in one sense. I'm sure you're familiar or have heard the term that technology and innovation goes through some kind of a hype cycle. You know, the first time you hear about a 3D printer and you're like, oh, that's really interesting. So 3D printers are going to be able to make hearts. They're going to be able to make this. We'll have one in our house. If I run out of a hammer, I just make one on 3D. Okay, well, the first time you heard about it was like 8 years ago, and nobody has a 3D printer. You remember there were like 3D printer stores. You walk in, it's just like this cool thing that takes an hour to make a piece of garbage. And so you're early in the hype cycle. Bitcoin and kind of the blockchain, to me, their hype cycle was probably 2014 to 2017. You started hearing it at cocktail parties. You started hearing it kind of go through. Now we're through that part, and I think we're in the early innings of the biggest part of the market, which is the adoption stage. And I'll tell you why, because I'll give you a sports analogy that, again, I just thought of as we're going here. I like doing these because I come up with new work to to shove my company in with my own podcast. I think we're at the early stages of the most important stage. So overall, I'd say we're in the third inning of people needing to have crypto in their portfolio. We're in the adoption stage where I think by the end of the year, investors that are listening to this, which is why you should do one of these constantly. I'll come across the street whenever you need me because I'm very big on trying to get people to have 5 to 10% in their investment portfolio. But at the end of the year, I think people will be calling up their local politicians saying, hey, I had a really bad year in my portfolio because I can't invest in Bitcoin yet. There's no ETF. There's no this. I can't do anything. And I think that's going to happen. For the sports analogy, it's really a question for me of money and talent. So let me give you a couple of an example that recently has not worked. So Phil Mickelson, you're familiar with what happened to him. So he kind of gets involved with this competing golf league. So they got tons of money. Okay, we want you guys to come over here. So he blows up. He is willing to go make some statements, whatever. But if all the talent went there, you have a new ecosystem and a new thing. So what I care about when there's competing products, like for the NFL, for baseball, if you're going to compete with something, there's two things you need. You can put as much money in as you want, but you need the talent to go too. What I've started to see over the last year is the talent in all industries is moving to the crypto world. And it's happening in industries that we know. Tom Brady has a crypto business, like sports people. So all the superstars get it. But talent inside of the technology world in Silicon Valley, when you listen to the people that run Facebook, the people that run Google, the people that run Apple, and they get asked the question, how is it with labor? Well, we're under extreme pressure from crypto. That's just going to continue to grow. And what has based Silicon Valley on their model working, if you remember the show Silicon Valley that was on HBO, funny show, good show, it's a hope and a dream. Silicon Valley and entrepreneurs are about a hope and a dream. And they're willing to do this time and time again if they believe in what they're doing and they believe the upside is there. If stock prices in the public markets are going down, it's really hard to attract talent to companies to give them stock options on things that they don't believe in anymore. For the crypto world, people are moving there because they believe it's going to be a disruptive force. And so you're getting talent and money going in. And I think that's the most powerful reason why we're in the third inning. And the third to seventh of any hype cycle is where you want to be involved.
So with that, you know, like thinking about, you know, on the cusp of this kind of like, you know, wide adoption or like ubiquitous kind of like usage globally more than anything else. How do you expect kind of market prices for cryptos to kind of react in that type of environment overall? You know, is that something just where there's a lot more adoption, however, prices don't really move? Mm-hmm. Or do you think, you know, there's kind of like an underpinnings of kind of like a next leg up, if you will?
What I would want to see, because a rotation is this, and I live in a world where you said market neutral pioneer. That means we run a portfolio that we're trying to be able to make money regardless of what the markets are doing. That means we run a long side and a short side. So we're looking for relative outperformance. So I mentioned the rotation. The interesting thing to watch and what everyone should be paying attention to, not that Bitcoin's down this year, but that Bitcoin is outperforming ARK and it's outperforming the NDX. So it's outperforming technology. What that means is in a downturn, what was everyone worried about with Bitcoin? Oh, it's too volatile. I can't be in it. Well, this year, it's less volatile than ARK and it's less volatile than NASDAQ. People have that in their portfolio. Bitcoin is hanging in there. And usually what that means, I'm a Kentucky Derby fan. I write a paper on it every year. It'll be on my website next week. Everyone can go check it out. I believe that at some point you want to see horses that are being held back. When there's a rotation and everything's going down, if the horse is being held back and you're waiting at the end, it just releases and it goes and it's going faster. I think when the market stops going down, which I do think for equity markets, I don't know when you're going to put this out. So, you know, as we speak right now, I think we're close to the lows of the year in stocks. I could be wrong. There's plenty of times where I am, but I think we are. If we are, I think, you know, non-tech stocks will lead the way, but I think Bitcoin will go up dramatically. And I've said publicly, and I'll keep saying it on everything I go on, I think by the end of the year, Bitcoin will double from where it is today, which means I think it'll see, you know, 80,000 before the end of the year from where it is. I don't think stocks are going to double from here, and I certainly don't think tech stocks are going to double from here, which means Bitcoin outperformed on the way down, and it will have outperformed on the way up. And those are the types of things that, as a firm that's market neutral, you're looking for that relative strength.
So, you know, you kind of mentioned something interesting, right? So it's like a belief that at least at present, you know, you're thinking through is that, you know, crypto assets, Bitcoin has a chance to rally. Stocks likely, or, you know, more likely than not in your estimation, rally as well, led by non-tech, so kind of, you know, less cyclical, more, you know, just value, energy, I imagine, all part of it. But then you mentioned tech probably lagging thereafter. You know, I think a lot of people had always kind of associated or coupled tech and crypto together. Why do you think you're seeing such a strong decoupling overall? And I know you mentioned a little bit about the rotation overall, but, you know, do you not think that there's a bid for both if you know, sentiment kind of turns?
So, no. I think U.S. tech companies are under a significant pressure. I mean, just to give you an idea, Apple's market cap is bigger than the entire crypto market cap. So let's just remember, you know, one thing. The fiat system is a Ponzi scheme. And what I mean by that is if you took all of the underlying physical currency that exists in the world, it's not that much. Assets are worth $500 trillion, which means that when you buy a house, you have something of value that's a lot more than the money that you actually have in the house. And more importantly, the actual currency that's physically could be out there. So everyone knows if they watch It's a Wonderful Life during the holiday season, a run on a bank is when everyone tries to get their money out of the bank at the same time. Well, that's a Ponzi scheme, basically, even though it's not. It's called fractional banking reserve system. But the global system has this. So technology's valuation is enormous, while crypto's valuation is very small. So it's not that the crypto world can, you know, will follow tech. If the fiat system is going down in its Ponzi scheme, right now we have bonds down in a record year. We have stocks down a lot. So everyone's portfolio is going down. Bitcoin has to go down because it's part of the fiat system. And there's people that are being impacted that need to get money, because what you said is the way a lot of people think about this, which is they think of this as just another innovation, and they're trying to invest in it the same way they did for Web 1.0 and Web 2.0. Web 1.0 and Web 2.0 were completely dominated by the United States. Web 2.0 had a little bit of competition from China. China shut down our companies inside their country, and then they focused on their own. So we all know Alibaba now. We know Tencent. We know these competitors. But when I would travel to China, they started shutting down Facebook. They started shutting down Twitter. They started shutting down Amazon. They started doing a bunch of things to have their own companies to compete with it. Well, the rest of the world was not able to do that. So we controlled VC. China had some of it. But for the most part, even now, we're about 70% of global VC. If you put China and the U.S. together, we're still over 90%. And that just means Web 1.0 and 2.0 was dominated solely by first the U.S., then U.S. and China. So when you say technology, what you're really saying is the United States. And that's the difference, because when I say, hey, what European app do you use on your phone every day? And people may not know one, but it's Spotify. We just started to get competition. When Facebook fell this year, people were like, what happened? Well, they were hit by global companies. Which one? TikTok, Chinese company. Like, the world is changing, and technology in the U.S. is really the issue. We're getting competition all over the world, and we never had that ever before. So the best analogy I can give for sports people, and I like to use that because a lot of people that don't follow crypto, sports is a good other side of the equation. How many European basketball players were great 30 years ago? And now the NBA is littered with not only good European players, but European basketball has caught up in many ways, in the same way that U.S. hockey was kind of non-existent in the 80s relative to Canada, Russia, and the rest of the world. And now they have real players. At some point here, you get more competition. And right now, U.S. technology is having competition from all over the world, and crypto is a measurement of that. And so I think crypto is eating into U.S. technology. So if crypto is doing well, it will continue to take talent and money from these companies. So I view it as a disruptive force, which is why this is called the innovation rotation.
In technology, just kind of like, are there winners, or is the whole sector kind of under pressure? Is there a lot of consolidation? Or is this kind of like, you know, a situation like the turn of the century where all of a sudden people just kind of don't consider technology investing for a period of 5 to 7 years as it works through all of its challenges?
This might be the most controversial angle I have even within the crypto side, because many of the crypto people, including podcasts that I've done with them, they're also investors in private markets, private tech companies. So they have a lot of money in crypto, but they're also invested in a lot of late stage companies they've been involved in waiting to go public. Now, those companies have had a real, like the ones that have gone public, and just Uber and, mm-hmm. you know, places like that, they've had a tough couple years. IPOs have gone straight down with inside the biotech and tech side. SPACs have gone down. These have been big parts of the market. And the public markets, the companies that are already out there that maybe didn't go public recently, but the ARK type names, most of them have been hit hard too, even the blockchain ones. So what you have here is some kind of repricing of this stuff. And I'm going to keep saying it over and over again. I think the investment time horizon to go from early stage to late stage to public is completely being disrupted by crypto. The pace of innovation, we all know, is exponential. We've all seen Moore's Law. We've all seen how quickly things are going faster than they did before. Crypto's competitiveness, the barriers to entry, the ability to raise money in crypto in like the GoFundMe way and take that to an idea and then to be able to just launch it quickly. I'm sure a lot of people listening, they were questioning how their kids were making so much money in crypto. They're on Reddit, they get an idea, they put it to work, and it takes off. Well, the VC world, they would always brag, I see all the stuff before anyone sees and it's all good. I think by the time you see it, the concept of incumbents and moats is over. So if you can't get a moat around your business because competitors come up so quickly, you never actually get out of the early, you never get to the late stage. You're a good early stage company, but now all of a sudden there's competition. And then by the time you go public, there's just too much competition. And so whether it's a WeWork or some of these others, I think they all either pivot into other industries and businesses that maybe they shouldn't to get their valuation up. And I just think this is becoming a difficult process that they're never actually able to make money the way that they would because they have too big of a plan because the dollars they're getting are just too big.
So Jordy, just kind of as we get close to wrapping here, what are some kind of final thoughts that are really top of mind for you today that we haven't really gotten to?
So one of them is the fact that for everyone who is, I would say, worried about investing in crypto, you should be less worried now because of what you've seen with the NASDAQ and with ARK and with all of these kind of innovation names. I think you have to start to pay attention to the fact that Bitcoin might be a new innovation, a new technology, but it's more than a currency, it's an ecosystem. And if you start paying attention more to what it is, the blockchain, Web 3.0, and that's the place that I would direct people, don't focus on it as a currency, as a payment system, as anything as that. You have to view it as the thing that is the most important, which is a disruptive technology. When you have a disruptive technology, it will disrupt the existing businesses, but you have to find out how to invest in it. And the problem is, Web 1.0 was about picking companies into 2000. Web 2.0 began basically in 2005 to 2006, and that was the social growth. That was the App Store, all of that, the iPhone. And so the social platforms created this thing of community. What you're investing in Bitcoin is the natural movement from there, which is to go from social platforms and communities, you need communities to build companies with inside the blockchain. It's all about communities. And that's what we're going into. It's the borderless internet. And I think it's just a more powerful thing. So stop reading on crypto, put some money into it, view it as no different than the rest of your portfolio. Force your FA to call up me at Weiss and I'll talk to them and take them through it and give them some thoughts. But I think the reality is you have to become less scared of it and a little bit more educated.
And so, you know, obviously a lot of insights you provide us today. You mentioned your podcast a couple of times. How can people, learn more from you and or listen more often?
First of all, the website, I do a lot of webinars on the market too, and I do a lot of writing, and that's at gweiss.com, gweiss.com. And then The podcast is titled In Search of Green Marbles. It's on Apple and Spotify and every other place you go. And I'm on Twitter now. So I forget what my Twitter handle is, Jordy Visser, Weiss. I only started doing the social last week, and on there, there's three things that I'm doing on a daily basis. One is kind of two stats that I'm looking at each day. So I talked about sentiment today and where two-year rates were and the trends that have been going on and what I think is necessary for the market to stabilize. Second thing is I'm doing some kind of a crypto tweet every day, trying on the innovation rotation. And the final thing is, as I mentioned, I'm a huge Kentucky Derby fan. My paper will be up on that website on the Insights tab. It gets a lot of press. I spend a lot of time. It's a lot of pages. So that way, when you're sitting around with your friends with your mint juleps on Saturday of next week, you can just open it up and you'll get a better sense of how I approach markets and the way that I handicap things like recessions and crypto in general.
That's fantastic, and we certainly encourage everyone to check out all the content and insights that you make available. But Jordy, thank you so much for joining us today. Thank you, of course, to all of our listeners, and remember to visit www.yieldstreet.com to learn more about our offerings, and of course, subscribe to our YouTube channel so you never miss a show. Thank you so much, and see you next week.
Thanks, Peter.
Thank you for listening to this week's episode of The Yield. For the latest updates on the alternative investing space, go to yieldstreet.com. Be sure to subscribe to this podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and Stitcher. If you enjoyed the show, feel free to leave a review on Apple Podcasts, as this will help other investors like yourself find our show. If you have any questions, please visit us at yieldstreet.com. Thanks again for listening, and see you next week. The Yield Street podcast you just heard only reflects the opinions of the host, who is an associated person of Yield Street, and does not necessarily reflect the views of Yield Street or any of its affiliates or other associates. The podcast is for informational purposes only and is not intended to be and should not be construed as a recommendation to buy or sell any security, and is not an offer or sale of any securities or investment product. The podcast is also not a research report and is not intended to be and should not be construed as investment advice.
Support for this podcast comes from Yield Street. Trying to time the stock market can lead to regret. At Yield Street, our alternative investments are designed to create predictable secondary income streams, providing you with tools to help put your money to work immediately. These investments in asset classes like art, real estate, and legal finance typically have low correlation with the stock market and target annual yields up to 7-10%. Welcome to the next generation of investing. Welcome to Yield Street. Sign up today at yieldstreet.com.